Let's see here. Welcome to the Danger Zone here at the Santa Cruz Voice and KSEO.com. I am your host, Jim Too. And today's show, it is Friday, April 10, 2026, as I record this episode. Sorry, I just got lost in the music for a little while. So, news of the day, I guess, the two big themes are, again, Iran and our local state of California. So let's see here. What starts off this stack of stuff? And I guess this was a post from on April 7th, so about 3 days ago, in relation to the Easter rescue of the downed pilot of the F-15 near Isfahan. And this is from David Strom over at hotair.com in his blog post, April 7th, Benghazi versus Isfahan. I have been frankly gobsmacked by the left's reaction to the miraculous return of our brave F-15 Wizzo over the past couple of days. I wasn't surprised to find that many on the left would root for Iran to capture or kill our airmen. But I frankly was that they were so open about it and so dismissive of the efforts we made to save him and our willingness to risk so many lives and spend so much money for one airman. The not-so-secret wish that Iran will pull off a propaganda coup was simple TDS. That's Trump derangement syndrome for you wine moms in Capitola. And hence, predictable. The churlishness of our success was another thing entirely. Already, I have seen several liberal accounts describe our efforts to defend the WSO as he waited for rescue as a war crime. I'm not kidding. Because we created a 3-kilometer buffer zone around him using air power, killing anybody who entered the no-go zone, they claim was indiscriminate killing. Oh, okay. Let's see here. No innocent civilians were rushing to the top of a ridge. They were either chasing a $60,000 reward or they were the besieged. The besieged are the religious police in the Iranian regime. But anyways, why do you think there was a massive firefight? I shouldn't be surprised, though. I should have remembered Benghazi, where the White House directed the U.S. military against strenuous objections to abandon Americans to a Libyan mob. Let's see here. Our ambassador, Christopher Stevens, was murdered and paraded through the city because the Democrats think leaving Americans to be mutilated by savages is a small price to pay. Yeah. And of course, you know, that is a big difference, right? Because do you remember Benghazi from, I think it was like 2012 or something like that? But anyways, I mean, in the end, Hillary Clinton was testifying in front of Congress. You know, yeah, and I think her phrase was, what difference does it make? Well, I think we now see the difference that it makes. Under Trump, if possible, we will move heaven and earth to rescue one American that fights for us, right? Under Obama and Hillary Clinton, they don't care. They didn't care, right? They resisted efforts to rescue or defend 4 Americans that were basically left to die at an American consulate in Libya in the town of Benghazi. So if you ever wonder what difference does it make, that's the difference that it makes. And of course, you know, it'd be nice if we could celebrate, you know, certain things like, you know, saving somebody. But no, I guess, you know, people are upset about this. And, you know, and why? Why would they do that? Who knows why they would do that? But, you know, here's old Larry O'Donnell over at MS Now, being offended.
That brilliant rescue was described by the Secretary of Defense and by General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as a long-standing American military rule of never leaving anyone behind.
We leave no man behind.
That is, of course, the old-school version of the idea back when only men flew American military planes. General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, put it this way.
We leave no one behind.
The general knows, unlike Pete Hegseth, that could have been a woman they were trying to rescue, and it might be a woman the next time.
So Larry O'Donnell's beef with the rescue of an airman was Pete Hegseth saying, "We will leave no man behind," as opposed to, "We will leave no one behind." Yeah. I guess if that is the biggest thing that you can complain about, that's that to which I would then quote Hillary Clinton and say, what difference does it really make? We will rescue anyone, man, woman, or whatever the transgender is there are now complaining about, if they're fighting for us and they get caught behind enemy lines and we can do it successfully. I mean, what a strange concept that must be for liberals who are used to leaving men and women and equipment all behind for the enemies to take, kill, violate, and all that stuff. But be that as it may, I guess it was a fun little contrast this week where you can see how people quickly turn on a dime, where at the beginning of the week, Trump was a war, insane war criminal who was going to commit genocide of the Persian people. And then within less than 48 hours, taco, Trump always chickens out or something like that. Here is an interesting article from France24.com. And this is, what's the date of this? This is April 7th, and it doesn't look like it has a byline. So, you know, I can't mock anybody. Trump's threatened destruction of Iranian infrastructure could be a war crime, legal experts say. So, in his news conference, Donald Trump threatened to blow up every bridge and power plant in Iran, an action that would be far-reaching, that so far-reaching that some experts in military law said would constitute a war crime. The issue could turn on whether the power plants were legitimate military targets, whether the attacks were proportional compared to what Iran has done, and whether civilian casualties were minimized. Trump's threat was so broad it did not seem to account for the harm to civilians, prompting Democrats in Congress, some United Nations officials, and scholars in military law to say that strikes would violate international law. The president's eventual actions often fall short of his all-encompassing rhetoric in the moment, but his warnings about power plants and bridges are unambiguous both on Sunday and Monday as he set a deadline for Tuesday night to open the Strait of Hormuz. So, just curious of all those military scholars and experts that are saying, hey, you know, this is potentially a war crime, shooting bridges and stuff, right? Well, I like to bring this little article from The Los Angeles Times, April 6, 1999. That was more than, I would say, how many years? 27 years ago today, right? The story of bridge bombing builds support. This bicycling home from work the other day is Vladimir Zabjar was one of the people on the other side of a smart bomb video seen on U.S. television. The story of people on the Danube River Freedom Bridge near the city of Novi Sad hit by precision NATO bombing Saturday night was described in detail Monday in the independent Belgrade daily Glas Javosni, one of Yugoslavia's more respected newspapers. Powerful in its descriptions and possible confirming details, the bridge bombing story and the kind of reporting used to explain it to the Serbs helps explicate the apparent growing support seen across the country for the Yugoslav president, Slobodan Milosevic. So, when Bill Clinton was president in 1999, we were bombing bridges in Yugoslavia, or, you know, I guess now we call it the Balkans. So, Serbia, Crimea, Croatia, you know, Montenegro, Bosnia, or whatever, right? Were those international legal experts in military law opining that bombing bridges in Yugoslavia was a violation of international law, possibly a war crime? No. Now, you might say, hey, man, that was 27 years ago. Some of these military experts probably weren't even alive then, or maybe they were just little toddlers or something like that. You know, okay, fair enough. Let's speed it up a bit to something a bit more recent. I have two words for you: Kerch Bridge. For those of you who have the memory, of a guppy, and of course, you know, I probably also have a memory of a guppy, or is it a goldfish? I forget again because I have a memory of one of those fishes that have a short memory. But during the Russia-Ukraine war, which is still ongoing, if I might add, the Ukrainians have taken multiple pot shots at the Kerch Bridge, right? And, you know, at the time, the media being mostly, at least the Western media being mostly pro-Ukrainian, was cheering the bombing and attacks on the Kerch Bridge. Did you hear any of them, these so-called military experts that are waxing poetic about Donald Trump threatening to take out bridges in Iran? Were these experts also waxing poetic about, hey, the Ukrainians might be violating international law and committing war crimes? I think not. You know, I would bet you that the Democrats who are in Congress, who are accusing Donald Trump of committing war crimes or threatening war crimes and, you know, in trying to invoke the 25th Amendment and or impeachment or whatever, were they complaining about the Ukrainians bombing the Kerch Bridge in the crime, connecting Crimea to the Russian mainland or whatever? No. And that just goes to show you how they have to make bleep up, as the case may be. But they have to make stuff up to, you know, this is a war crime. And of course, you know, Russia has been attacking Ukrainian power stations. And I bet you money Ukraine has been attacking Russian power stations and infrastructure. Throughout all that, did you hear any waxing poetic about war crimes? Probably not. Or maybe they attacked the Russians for committing war crimes and not the Ukrainians, or vice versa, depending on which, you know, whose side you're on, so to speak. But I would just say, yeah, they just, you know, they're you know, people who hate Trump are just looking for some reasons to get at him. But, you know, and the reasons, the things they cite aren't really that great. Now, you could say there are legitimate criticisms, but, you know, war crime, not one of them. This is from donserber.substack.com. April 10, the art of the deal met Sun Tzu in Iran. Trump is also spanking Britain, France, and Red China. He talks about, you know, what he's doing in Iran. And then he always points, he's like this, you know, what was it? Yeah, there's a ceasefire, supposedly. But he points out the commander-in-chief is in no hurry to exit the scene. The Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier is still in place. And the George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier is headed to the Med to relieve the Gerald R. Ford. 2,500 Marines remain from the USS Tripoli. And then there are elements of the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit. And then there's 2,500 more are coming in from San Diego. And then the 82nd Airborne is also sending more people. This is how Trump, from Mr. Server's call, this is how Trump negotiates. He catches the enemy off guard and keeps them guessing on what he is up to. And to be honest with you, do any of us really know what he's going to do next? Probably not. We can point out all the possibilities, but we really don't know. But he's in a position to do any of those things. And, you know, now let's see here. With regards to Iran's 10-point proposal, isn't worth the toilet paper Trump wipes his butt with. The Ayatollah deserved the treatment the Godfather gave Jack Walls, waking up in bed beside the head of his champion thoroughbred cartoon. But that's Hollywood. In reality world, Trump had Israel bomb the Ayatollah at breakfast. The best part of his waking up was the Blue Sparrow missile in his cup. Let's see here. Operation Epic Fury has Trump in his natural element because he is the master of the art of the deal, which is the name of his first best-selling book. In it, he said, "Deals are my art form. Other people paint beautifully on canvas, or write wonderful poetry. I like making deals, preferably big deals. That's how I get my kicks," unquote. Haters gotta hate, but there are 14 Trump towers in places like New York, Chicago, Sunny Isles Beach, Florida, Las Vegas, Istanbul, Manila, Mumbai. How many Biden towers are there? Clinton, Schumer? We have seen the garbage pail structure Obama's building for his presidential library. Trump's towers use modernist and postmodernist architecture. Obama's is strictly DI. Its concrete is already failing 2 months before it opens. Trump also said in his book, "Leverage. Don't make deals without it." That's where the U.S. military comes in. By providing muscle, the military gives American government and the chief executive of the branch the leverage we need. Which brings us to Sun Tzu, who gave us the art of war 2,500 years ago. Perhaps the best bit of advice he gave was, quote, "Victorious warriors win first, then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win," unquote. The Pentagon spent the past 47 years planning Operation Epic Fury. Iran spent the past 6 weeks trying to catch up because the regime has never considered that the first thing Trump would do was to kill Iran's top leadership. Huh? Well, maybe, or maybe it was the Israelis. The importance of the extraction of Maduro did not register with the Ayatollah. Our frenemies, Britain, France, Italy, and Spain, thought that without consequence, they could cockpit block us by not allowing us to use our air bases in their countries to the conduct of war. Thank you, Mr. Server, for using cockpit as opposed to the other one, because otherwise I couldn't put it on the radio. Let's see here. So, yeah, that'll be the interesting thing is, he's setting up the so that if anything goes either way, sideways, forward, backwards, he's got options. And I think that's part of why you do what you do. But, for all those people who are hating on it, and there are legitimate criticisms or concerns about going to war in Iran, such as... this is from Zero Hedge for today, April 10th. Core CPU prints cooler than expected despite biggest jump in energy prices in 2005. So while PCE, expenditures, showed some signs of higher energy prices leaking into inflation prints, it was still February data. As we previewed, today's CPI data is for March and will bear the full brunt of the Iran war's impact on energy prices after core CPI fell to its lowest in 4 years in February. The headline CPI soared 0.9% month-to-month as expected, while it was the big month-to-month jump, consumer prices rose 3.3% year-to-year, up from 2.4% in February, but below the 3.4% year-to-year expected. So, inflation's back up again. It's up by a pretty decent amount because, from 2.4 to 3.3% is a big jump, and that was reflected entirely in fuel or gasoline prices because of our war. So yeah, that's a legitimate concern, but do you remember when inflation hit over 9, CPI went over 9% in 2022? What all the Democrats and all the Biden apologists were saying? Oh, it's just because of reopening the economy and it's going to be transitory. That was the word. The spike in inflation would be transitory. And it lasted throughout the entirety of the Biden administration and probably still is lingering to a bit now. So, it wasn't transitory then. But I suspect, and this is the word I will use right back at the Democrats' faces who used the word transitory in 2022. 4 years later, this inflation is likely transitory. And we can point it out to where it is. It's basically... And when the Iran issue resolves to the point where oil tankers are flowing freely, sailing the Strait of Hormuz freely at 100 to 135 tankers a day, this current inflation is going to go away. Or it will go back down into the low 2% range, 2 to 2.5%. But that's a prediction. And thankfully, we will find out within, let's say, about 6 months. And if I'm wrong, someone can always... call me on Flight 1080 at KSCO every Tuesday from 4 to 6 p.m. and remind me that I said this on this podcast. Well, assuming you listen to the podcast anyways. But some good news, I would say, because it all can't be all bad news, right? What did Donald Trump accomplish this week? Well, he did get the ceasefire, which may or may not be holding. But, I think here's another one just for you haters out there. This is from the DHS website. Trump administration delivers 11 straight months of zero releases at the border. April 9 is the date of the press release. Today, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Customs and Border Patrol announced the U.S. Border Patrol's 11th consecutive months of zero releases at the southern border, continuing the trend of historically low border crossings. Quote, 11 straight months of zero releases at the border under President Donald Trump's leadership, we are delivering the most secure border in American history, said DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. Quote, the world knows America's borders are closed to lawbreakers. America First policies, real consequences, and unified federal effort backed by personnel, infrastructure, technology are how we've delivered the most secure border in U.S. history, said CBP Commissioner Rodney Scott. Under President Trump and Secretary Mullen, we are building a network of what works, refining our approach, and locking in real border security. This isn't temporary. This is it's the new normal. So, you know, the weird thing, I mean, right? Under Biden, I think we were averaging 10,000 border crossings and releases into the border every day. So the fact that we went 11 straight months with zero, you know, border crossings that we let people into the country is a huge improvement, as the case may be. But yeah, so be that as it may. Let's see. Do I have anything in the stack of stuff that might be relevant? Let's see here. For those of you who were saying, well, we went into Iran with no clear goals. This is a response from Dan Kane, General Dan Raisin Kane on February 28th, basically reminding us what the three goals were. And this is on February 28th. Here are the goals for those of you who missed this. And of course, Trump said this, Marco Rubio said this, Pete Hegseth said this, but haters just kind of get deaf when they hear things that always contradict their worldview. But so again, for the haters, this is for you.
On February 28th, the President of the United States ordered the Joint Force to execute Operation Epic Fury with the direction to accomplish three distinct military objectives: destroy Iran's ballistic missile and drone capabilities, destroy the Iranian Navy, and destroy their defense industrial base to ensure that Iran cannot reconstitute the ability to project power outside their borders. Over the course of 38 days of major combat operation, the joint force achieved the military objectives as defined by the president. We welcome the ongoing ceasefire, and as the secretary said, we hope that Iran chooses a lasting peace. But as Secretary Hegseth said, let us be clear, a ceasefire is a pause, and the joint force remains ready if ordered or called upon to resume combat operations.
So what were the goals? Wipe out the Navy, take out their ballistic missiles and drones, and three, take out their capacity to manufacture more missiles and drones. Right? Now, is there regime change anywhere in that list of things? I don't see it, but hey, I view that as a bonus. But, you know, again, those are the three goals. And I'm sure, you know, getting the nuclear dust, as the Orange Man Bad would say, is probably high up on that list. But I guess time to shift gears to the California section of the podcast here. This is from theamericanthinker.com, and I'm sure it's just there are other sources that are reporting the similar story. But Monica Showalter, April 7, Democrats pitch Eric Swalwell over the side in California governor's race with sex harassment allegations rolling out of the woodwork. Let's see here. When Democrats want to get rid of someone, they wheel out the women with sexual harassment allegations. Apparently, so many of them it's become part of a playbook for ridding the party of liabilities, often about other matters. It happened to Elliot Spitzer. It took down Andrew Cuomo. Now it's Eric Swalwell's turn. According to the Daily Caller, a Democratic activist says she's working with multiple women preparing to come forward with sexual harassment allegations against California Democrat Rep. Eric Swalwell. Cheyenne Hunt, a lawyer, one-time congressional candidate, and executive director of Gen Z for Change, revealed that she has been working with unspecified number of women set to accuse Swalwell in multiple ex posts early Monday morning. Swalwell is currently leading candidate in the crowded race to succeed Democrat California Governor Gavin Newsom. Quote, "I got involved because the first victim who approached me is a close friend. But when I saw that there were others whose experiences fit the same pattern of manipulation and abuse of power, I knew I couldn't stay silent," Hunt wrote in her X thread. She specified the allegations concerned DMs, which are direct messages for you, my wine moms in Capitola, and Snapchat messages, and range from uncomfortable comments to potentially criminal conduct, unquote. Well, ahem. Seems a lot of this was already known, but the press and the political establishment covered for him. That enabled him to do it again and again, shielded not just by the press and the abundant non-disclosure agreements he forced complainants to sign, but by the entire Democrat power establishment, which kept all the secrets, the Daily Caller report said dozens. I think I have Cheyenne's. See, do I have Cheyenne's thing here? All right. I think I have Cheyenne's ex post here.
The Democratic candidate currently leading in the California governor's race has a known history of being predatory towards women. And while it may be seen as politically expedient to sweep this under the rug, it is the wrong thing to do, and we know it. I worked on the Hill, I know many women who still do, and this message that I received yesterday is not unique. I have received others, and there are many women who have reached out to other political commentators and to reporters with their stories. This particular message follows the same pattern as the other allegations currently circulating. You know Eric Swalwell has slept with many of his interns and makes them all sign NDAs so they don't speak up, right? And when I was 19, he tried hitting on me and sliding into my DMs, and I have so many other friends that have similar experiences with him. Like I said, this message that I received is not an anomaly.
I'm not sure if Cheyenne is reading from someone else's message to her or her own personal experience when she mentioned, quote, he hit on me when I was 19, but... Yeah, let's keep playing.
It's part of a pattern. Other commentators have come forward, like this one, saying that no less than a dozen people have come forward to them alleging that Swalwell has had inappropriate relationships with young staffers for years. I understand that because the Trump administration is currently trying to weaponize similar allegations against Swalwell, having this conversation or publicly acknowledging it may feel like aligning with Trump, but that is not the truth. It is aligning with women. Politically, if this is a weakness that Trump can exploit, then it's something that we do need to acknowledge. And more important, morally, if we as a party are willing to bury these kinds of allegations, we are no better than those we point the finger at. Lastly, I would not be surprised if we soon see many other folks come forward. Conversations that I have had suggest that creators who have heard these stories and women who have experienced it are currently sitting on the sidelines because they're afraid of retaliation, of not being able to work in this space anymore if they speak up. But I think as more people come forward, we will hear other voices coming in and echoing these allegations. So we need to deal with this and address this now.
Okay. Now, first off, unless Cheyenne is someone that Eric Swalwell tried to sleep with, this is all still hearsay, right? We don't actually know any of the accusers, and we don't know what the accusations are other than generically sexual harassment and sex. And we don't know, and there's no way to verify it, right? For a lot of these things, it's going to be a he said, she said kind of thing. And, you know, and sadly, I mean, people will let their political bias weigh who to believe. So the example I would give is Brett Kavanaugh, right? Christy Blasey Ford comes out from the blue and accuses Brett Kavanaugh of trying to rape her or something like that when she was like 13 years old. She couldn't provide any details about where, when, the precise date, the location. She just said that, she identified Kavanaugh and one other dude, and then said, I had a friend of mine and another dude were downstairs. And of course, when they found, talked to all the people, Kavanaugh, the two dudes, and her friend, none of them could corroborate. They said, no, this never happened. Or it's like, she must be thinking about somebody else, I think was what her friend said, right? So zero corroboration, right? And the lack of detail is just hilarious, given the fact that old Brett Kavanaugh kept a date book of like all his appointments since he was 15. So he actually had his old, I think it's a day planner, I think is what it was called, right? Everything he did, he put it in his little book, and nothing showed he was ever, in her vicinity, so to speak, other than the fact they both lived in Maryland. Okay, So my suspicion is, I have to apply the rule I gave to Brett Kavanaugh. Just because someone's accused of something doesn't mean they're guilty of what they're accused of, right? You just not believe all victims, believe all women. It's believe the evidence, right? And right now we don't have any evidence. We don't even know who the allegators are. the people making the allegations, not the reptile or the amphibian in this case, maybe. But we don't. So, but does this sound plausible? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the thing that makes me think it's more likely to be true than not is that there are people who are on the record, you know, who are Democrat candidates, who are Democratic staffers and political strategists or whatever in D.C. who were on the record saying, oh, yeah, we all knew about this. Yeah, Eric has that had that reputation. So the fact that they're willing to go on the record and throw Swalwell under the bus, you know, tells me there might be more smoke or more fire than smoke. But we will see. Now, why? You know, for all this time, he's been, you know, he's been running, he's been in an elected office and maintaining a relatively high profile for the 400 and among the 435 members of Congress, right? He's above average, right? More people can name him beyond the people that live in his district, right? Because there are certain members of those 435 members of Congress that if you just said, do you know so-and-so is a member of Congress? You'd be like, huh? Right? So, but he's a relatively high profile guy. Why was this left? Why now? Is the question. That's the other question. Why now? And here's my tin pot political theory. I don't know if it's tin pot. It might be more conventional, but we'll see. The California gubernatorial primary is a jungle primary. The top two candidates who get in the primary go to the general election, regardless of party. Most of the current polls suggest or give a very high probability to the chance that the top two vote getters in the California jungle primary for the governor of the state of California will be Steve Hilton and Chad Bianco, the two Republicans, right? Why? Because I think there are eight somewhat prominent Democrats running in the jungle primary, right? And they've split up the vote of the Democrat vote. So that by doing that, that puts Hilton and Bianco, the two only serious Republicans, top one and two. So if we have the primary in early June of this year, and Steve Hilton and Chad Bianco come in first and second in the jungle primary, they will be running against each other in the general election, which means the next governor of California would be a Republican. And I think the Democrat Party doesn't want that, especially in the state of California, which is considered a very, very liberal, very blue Democrat stronghold. Right? Just doesn't look good, right? Now, initially, the Democrat Party has been calling on some of the Democrat candidates, but subtly, the ones that aren't doing so well in the polls to drop the F out of the race, all right? So if you are, oh my God, let's see if I can do the memory here. If you are Betty Yee, Antonio Villaraigosa, Xavier Becerra, or Tony Thurmond, right? The four Democrats that are kind of polling in like 1-2%, right? You know, they're not dropping out, right? And to be honest, if one of them dropped out, let's say, you know, you're like Betty Yee and you're at 1% in the polls, you know, whereas if the 1% all split up with the other remaining seven candidates or whatever, it's not going to put any one of the top leading Democrats into the top two, right? There's just not enough votes there. So what's the other way of doing it? Well, Eric Swalwell is one of the leading Democrats in the field, you take him out. He's got a lot of voters, you know, like 15% of the vote. You know, they can go at places, right? There's a lot of them, relatively speaking. And if a lot of them go to, let's say, one of the remaining top performing Democrat candidates, that's enough to put that one into the top two. You don't need to get two Democrats in the top. You just need to get one. Two is a bonus. But if you get one, then you go to the general election. It's whoever the Democrat is versus whoever the Republican is. California's an overwhelming Democrat state. You'll get a Democrat governor. And I think that is why. That is why the slime campaign to take down Eric Swalwell is happening now. And I don't think it's MAGA people, because I believe Ms. Hunt is nowhere near a MAGA person. She's a very progressive person. In fact, I think there was a picture of her on social media of her with her law professor back in the day, back at the UC Irvine School of Law. And guess who it was? Katie Porter. Maybe it was Katie Porter that sponsored the hit on Eric Swalwell. Could be Tom Steyer. You know, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, we'll see what happens here. Anyways, more to the California stack of stuff here. For all those people who think the idea of raising California's minimum wage to $30 an hour is a good idea, which is being proposed in Alameda County, which is where Oakland is, this might be something to think about. This is from the TFPPwire.com. New data shows California lost a staggering 36,565 fast food jobs since the $20 minimum wage kicked in. This is by Elizabeth Allen, June 6, 2025. Okay. California's $20 minimum wage law for fast food workers has triggered major job losses, business closures, and increased automation. The new federal data confirms what many warned would happen. Tens of thousands of entry-level jobs have vanished, and the damage continues to spread. When Assembly Bill 12, let's see, these are the key facts, because reading can be kind of boring. 36,565 fast food jobs have been lost in California since AB 1228 was signed into law in September of 2023. So when was this article written? 2025. Let's see. The $20 per hour minimum wage went into effect on April 24. Okay. So within a year, you lost about between September 23rd and April 2024, over 10,000 jobs were cut ahead of the implementation. Restaurants have rapidly moved to automation, digital kiosks, and reduced hours to offset labor costs. Fast food prices in California have jumped 14.5%, far above the national average of 8.2%. So here's the thing, right? I believe the official minimum wage in the state of California is $18 an hour, except for fast food workers, which is $20 an hour, right? So 36,565 people have lost their jobs since the raising of the fast food minimum wage from $18 to $20 an hour. Now, so here's a weird thing that I point out to people. It's like, well, if you can't afford your living wage, you shouldn't be able to do a job. People should be able to pay what they're worth. People should be paid what they're worth. Well, number one, no one really knows what anyone's really worth. It's just what, someone's willing to pay and what someone's willing to accept. But you're really not helping. You didn't help 36,565 people because they were making $18 an hour, right? And say if they're working full time, right? And now they're making nothing. So, maybe $18 an hour times 40 hours a week times 50 weeks a year may not be a lot of money to you. But going down from that to zero is a big, big hit. So you didn't do those people any favors. And here's the bonus point is that the people who remain. Yeah, technically their hourly wage went from $18 to $20 an hour, but what you've also realized is that those businesses that had to raise their minimum wage basically had to cut hours for those people. So they're getting less overtime, they're getting less benefits or whatever. So are you really doing them a favor, the ones that remain a favor, right? You've screwed 36,565 people of work. Because they went from whatever they were making, which is I think is probably about $3,000 a month to zero. Good job there, people. Yeah, and when you bring up these arguments to these people, they just kind of like, well, I don't eat fast food. It's like, okay, but that's not the point. Your point was we need to raise the minimum wage to help people. You point out here's an example of you raising the minimum wage. A whole bunch of people lost their jobs. The fact that you don't eat fast food doesn't, that's not a valid response to you've screwed people out of their livelihoods. But you shouldn't be able to work. It's like no, and here's another question, right? There are numerous states where the minimum wage is the federal minimum wage, right? Which is I think like $7.75 an hour, something like that, right? There are people who live in those states who make minimum wage in those states. Yet, they're not homeless, they're not living in their cars or whatever. I'm not saying they're living large, but they managed to, you know, put a roof over their heads. They're not starving. You know, they're not, you know, they may have some government assistance possibly, but you know, they managed to live their lives. Right. I mean, and compared to California, which has a highest poverty rate in the country, despite having an $18 minimum wage, right? Other states have a lower minimum wage or lower poverty rate than the state of California. When you factor in cost of living, right? So, you know, you could always look at the main poverty rate indicator in the Census Bureau or whatever, and it'll say like Mississippi and Louisiana have like higher poverty rates than the state of California. Look at the supplemental measure of poverty, which factors in the cost of living. And when you look at that, guess which state has the highest poverty rate? California. Anyway, that's a thought there. Let's see, what else is there? I guess, let's see here. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle for all those people who think Gavin Newsom would make a great, great governor. SF can continue handing out pipes, foil to drug user, judge rules. Aldo Toledo, Monday, April 6th. San Francisco and its nonprofits can continue to hand out pipes and foil to drug users in the heart of the city, a federal judge has ruled. In a decision on March 30th, U.S. District Judge John Teeger held that the city's long-established practice of allowing nonprofit contractors to distribute drug paraphernalia in the Tenderloin neighborhood. Teeger's decision denied a request by Tenderloin residents and business owners seeking to end the policy. They argued it put them in danger, attracted drug users and dealers to the area, and contributed to unsafe living conditions and increased crime. Those claims, according to Teeger's ruling, were unsupported by the evidence. Yep. Okay. I wonder if he's in the Oakland courthouse or he's in the San Jose courthouse, but you know, who knows? But you know, I'm sure Teeger's ruling legally on the merits of the law are correct, but as policy wise, I think handing out crack pipes and foil to crack users and fentanyl smokers is a terrible idea. But, you know, at least they're not handing out needles to the heroin addicts. Oh, wait, they are handing out needles to the heroin addicts. Sorry about that. Yeah, never mind. Anyways, also, this is from CBS News, I think from their 60 Minutes show, which makes me wonder, man, did they get hit in the head and accidentally commit journalism? Anyways, high-speed rail is commonplace in many other countries. Will it track in the U.S.? This is by John Wortham, David Levine, and Megan Listen, April 5th. With high-speed rail ambitions in California delayed by years and coming in at a higher-than-expected cost, Lou Thompson, who sat on the California's high-speed rail peer review group, said failure is always an option. Yep, that's California for you. He doesn't think failure is what will necessarily happen in California, but earlier ambitions have been scaled back. When California voters approved the bullet train between Los Angeles and San Francisco in 2008, the estimated price tag was $33 billion with a target completion date of 2020. Nearly two decades later, the California High-Speed Rail Authority is preparing to lay its first tracks to connect Bakersfield and Merced, a portion of the original route, with a target completion date of 2033. I might be dead by then, but anyways, quote, when you have a project like this and the budget no longer permits you to finish it the way you wanted to, you start cutting off your arms and legs, Thompson said. Boy, he's a very positive guy. I think I have a quote from somebody here. Oh yeah. This is from the 60 Minutes segment. They're quoting somebody else about this.
Cokes on Meshachin is California's Secretary of Transportation and Anthony Williams, a Rail Authority board member. Both are relatively new to the job, left to answer for their predecessors.
There were mistakes made. Some of the criticism on this project, I think, are very fair.
What happened?
I don't think the voters fully understood, and neither did we in the public sector, what it was going to take to actually get this project delivered.
To get the necessary political buy-in from the whole state, the plan called for the train to run inland, threading the farmland of the Central Valley. Yet the Rail Authority hadn't answered basic questions, like precisely where it could lay down its tracks, what's known as right-of-way.
3,000 parcels had to be negotiated just for the segments that we're working on today in the Central Valley.
It seems to me one farmer doesn't want high-speed rail going through his field, and you've got a guy that can gum up the works for a long time.
Yeah, that's what happens sometimes in these processes.
More snarl. California's exacting environmental regulations, which triggered all manner of reviews, lawsuits, and delays. As anyone who's renovated a home knows, delay adds to price.
Welcome to California, pal.
So do the high U.S. labor and construction costs.
Welcome to California, minimum wage.
At least compared to many other countries. And while the federal government contributed modestly under the Obama and Biden administrations, the burden fell largely on the state.
When construction started, was the financing there to complete this rail?
No,
it wasn't. Yeah. Let's be real. We had a lot to learn and we had a lot of growth to do. And, you know, it's arguable whether, you know, we should have been clearer about that.
No, it wasn't. And you know what the thing is? You know, well, I give this guy some credit from the California High Speed Rail Authority for at least admitting that. What his problem is that he doesn't admit the obvious. This thing ain't going to get built, at least as envisioned from San Francisco to Los Angeles, a two-hour trip. Right? They won't, you know, they're promising to get it from Bakersfield to Merced by 2033, right? That's like, what, like how many years from now? 7 years from now? It's a 100-mile loop, and that's the easiest part of the loop. And let's face it, you know, no shade on the people from Bakersfield to Merced. Are you guys really in need of a high-speed rail from Bakersfield to Merced? I mean, can't you just drive? I mean, right? How long does it take to drive from Bakersfield to Merced? You know, I mean, I would think it'd be better just to widen the road. I don't know if it's Highway 99 or Highway 5. Either one, just widen it out so that, you know, you can just drive. But, you know, and you talk to people, it's like, who are Democrats in California here, right? And you mention high-speed rail, that their eyes just kind of, huh, right? Oh, I'm sure I'm in favor of it because, you know, other countries have high-speed rail. Yeah, other countries don't have morons running the state, like Gavin Newsom or the Democrats in Sacramento, right? I mean, the fact that this thing was proposed in 2008. It was only supposed to cost $33 billion. It was supposed to be done by 2020. And here we are in 2026, and not a single mile of track has been laid. You know, almost 20 years later should tell you, no, this ain't gonna happen. You know, right? So the best thing to do is abort the project. End it. Don't mend it. Just end it right now. Just give the money back to whoever you got to give it back to. Give the land back to whoever the farmers that you took it from. Take all whatever you've built so far, which I'm assuming are some little bridges and, you know, whatever. Blow them up. You know, have a big like, you know, ceremony or whatever. If hey, Steve Hilton or Chad Bianco, one of you guys comes to the next governor, you can get this. You know, I would pay to see that. Just like, you know, have a big old press conference where you have a big, you know, a show for the media where you just show it like those Las Vegas casinos just being blown up. Just blow it all up. But we got, we'll see what happens in the future. You know, maybe we'll have Eric Swalwell as the governor or Katie Porter. You know, I still think that it'll be a Democrat that'll be the next governor of the state of California, even if Eric Swalwell drops out for banging his interns and his staffers. But anyways, we're nearing the end of the podcast. So thank you for listening to The Danger Zone. I've been your host, Jim Tu, and thank you for being here at the SantaCruzVoice.com and or KSCO.com, and have a great weekend.